This is a lecture series from Tikvah Ideas commemorating the Yom Kippur War on its 50th anniversary. Together, over the course of 6 lectures, we're going to explore what we know now about the war and what went on behind the scenes. In the previous lectures, I think I've made it clear that Anwar Sadat was the driving force behind the war. What I haven't yet explained is why he started it. And that's not a question with a straightforward or obvious answer. To try to get to one, I'd like to take you inside Sadat's head to understand the political experiences that shaped his thinking about the world and to put the Yom Kippur War into the bigger picture of Sadat's strategy. First, a brief overview. Sadat became president of Egypt in October 1970, just 2 months after the War of Attrition ended in a ceasefire. In 1973, Sadat assembled the Pan-Arab Coalition that delivered the worst military blow Israel had ever received. Then, in 1974 and 1975, he concluded the Sinai Disengagement Agreements, which reduced tensions with Israel in the wake of the Yom Kippur War. In 1977, he went to Jerusalem, becoming the first Arab leader to make an official visit to the Jewish state. In 1978, he met with Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin at Camp David, and the following year, he concluded the peace agreement with Israel. In other words, he gradually moved Egypt into making peace with its sworn enemy. And not only that, he also moved his country into the Western camp in the Cold War. From the perspective of half a century later, two things are obvious that were not at all clear to contemporaries. First, that Sadat's political transformation began well before the surprise attack on Israel in 1973. And second, that his plans for war and his plans for peace were inextricably intertwined. They were two separate strands wound into a single braid. In the early 1970s, the logic that tied the military and diplomatic moves together defied detection. It baffled even the savviest of observers. "I think the guy is highly unstable," Henry Kissinger told President Nixon in 1972. He was reacting to Sadat's decision to expel Soviet military personnel from Egypt. Sadat's pre-war diplomacy only affirmed the prevailing assumptions of Haconcepsia, the closed feedback loop that locked Israelis, and for that matter, Americans, into their conviction that Sadat would never launch a war. The Egyptian leader's diplomacy involved peace feelers one day and warlike threats the next. Reflecting on Sadat's surprise attack in 1973, Henry Kissinger writes in his memoirs that the highest policymakers in Washington and Jerusalem did not lack facts. The error lay in the conclusion drawn from them. He continues, "What literally no one understood beforehand was the mind of the man. Sadat aimed not for territorial gain, but for a crisis that would alter the attitudes into which the parties were then frozen, and thereby open the way for negotiations. The shock would enable both sides, including Egypt, to show a flexibility that was impossible while Israel considered itself militarily supreme and Egypt was paralyzed by humiliation." His purpose, in short, was psychological and diplomatic much more than military, end quote. In this episode, we will explore the mind of the man. We will seek to answer a very simple question. How did Sadat arrive at such a sophisticated strategy? A simple question deserves a simple answer, and it is this. Sadat had done it all before. Allow me to take you back to 1952. Back to some of the most formative political experiences in his life. In that year, the Free Officers Movement, led by Nasser, carried out a military coup. The Free Officers abolished the monarchy and exiled King Farouk. Sadat was a leading member of the group. In the next 4 years, Nasser and his fellow officers, including Sadat, expelled British forces from Egypt, seized the British-controlled Suez Canal Zone, aligned with the Soviet Union, and organized an anti-imperial network throughout the Arab world. Then, in October 1956, they weathered the coordinated attacks by a Franco-British expeditionary force and the IDF. When they first set this chain of events in motion, Nasser and Sadat were 34 years old. When it ended, they were 38. A better tutorial in international politics would be hard to imagine. 15 years before the Israelis began building the Bar-Lev line, Nasser and the Free Officers had already ousted one powerful enemy from along the Suez Canal. The lessons that Sadat learned from that experience, the experience of driving out the British, proved invaluable to him in 1973. Let's dig a little deeper into modern Egyptian history. The British first conquered the country in 1882. In February 1922, the United Kingdom issued a document called the Unilateral Declaration of Egyptian Independence. That document recognized Egypt as an independent sovereign state. In the eyes of the Egyptians, however, it was a complete sham. Egypt was a protectorate in all but name. The British military withdrew from Cairo and other major cities, and the Egyptian government began to administer the country's domestic affairs independently, but British troops continued to control the Suez Canal. Nasser, Sadat, and their cohort, therefore, considered their country to be under enemy occupation. From the geographic vantage point of Cairo, the Israeli occupation of Sinai in 1967 looked a lot like the British occupation in the 1950s. The British placed their forces in what they euphemistically called their base along the Suez Canal. A grand imperial structure, the base was actually a huge zone enveloping about 3/4 of the entire canal. It contained airfields, naval docks, barracks, storage depots, administrative buildings, and repair facilities. It housed tens of thousands of military personnel, including soldiers, sailors, and airmen. The base ensured British control of the canal, but it also safeguarded British imperial interests throughout the Middle East and East Africa. In 1952, Britain retained bases and security responsibilities in, among other places, Jordan, Iraq, Yemen, and the Persian Gulf. In sum, the Suez base served as the hub of the British regional security system. Like the Israelis 20 years later, the British had every intention of staying. Nasser understood that the Egyptian military lacked the power to oust the British. Dislodging the occupier would require instead a combination of diplomacy and military pressure. In the 1950s, Nasser therefore used Egyptian military power to manufacture a crisis that would draw in the outsiders who had enough power to oust the British, namely the Americans. Through the Egyptian journalist Mohammed Hassanein Haeckel, Nasser opened a direct channel to the American embassy, to William Lakeland, a young political officer. In many historical accounts, Lakeland is incorrectly identified as a CIA agent. Nasser was a frequent guest in the home of the Lakelands, an apartment overlooking the Nile. A few years before Lakeland died in 2015, I tracked him down in Berkeley, California, where he had worked for years in real estate. He painted an extraordinary picture. The Lakelands, Nasser, and Nasser's fellow revolutionaries would eat hot dogs and watch Hollywood movies together in Lakeland's home. Lakeland had access to Hollywood movies that were available exclusively to American embassy staff. He would use a projector to screen them on the wall of his apartment. Nasser had an especial fondness for Esther Williams films. Through Lakeland, Nasser cultivated the Americans. He disingenuously communicated to them his desire to warm relations with the United States in the Cold War. He suggested that he would keep the Arabs out of the Soviet camp and even help the United States stabilize the Arab-Israeli conflict, provided, and this is the key point, that President Eisenhower would help him free Egypt from British occupation. As for Sadat, his role in this effort had nothing to do with Esther Williams, hot dogs, or keeping the Americans happy. He organized military support for the Fedayeen, that is, for the guerrillas. The British would call them terrorists or jihadis, who killed British soldiers in the canal zone. Working with, among other groups, the Muslim Brotherhood and members of the Egyptian military disguised as civilians, Sadat helped Nasser make the argument to the Americans that a popular uprising was brewing and that only the departure of the British from Egypt could stop it. The Free Officers carefully calibrated the violence. If they overplayed their hand, the British would occupy Cairo and topple their new government. The right level of violence would bring the British just to the brink of launching a major operation against them. At the same time, it would conjure up in the American mind the specter of a major war. Nasser wanted the Americans to believe that more violence would inflame anti-Western opinion throughout the Arab world and would lead the Middle East into the waiting arms of the Soviet Union. The tactic worked. In May 1953, John Foster Dulles became the first American Secretary of State to make an official visit to Egypt. In the weeks prior to his arrival, the free officers turned up the attacks on the British to impress upon the Americans the direness of the situation. Dulles returned from the trip thoroughly convinced. He reported to Eisenhower that the association with British imperialism and with Zionism was destroying the American position in the Middle East. Courting Nasser was the top priority. Nasser was the moderate leader who would keep the Arabs in the Western camp in the Cold War. Dulles saw Nasser as the last best hope of the West in the Arab world. Eisenhower agreed. He responded by pressuring Prime Minister Churchill to leave Egypt. At first, Churchill tried to fight Eisenhower, but eventually he buckled to the pressure. In October 1954, his government signed an agreement to withdraw all troops from Egypt. Nasser had successfully borrowed American power to defeat the British Empire. From Nasser's point of view, 1954 was just the first step toward total victory. He wanted the British gone from the entire Middle East so that they could never come back to their Suez base. So he continued to organize a region-wide rebellion against them. That's why, in the end, Britain and France colluded with Israel in 1956. That is, they concocted a plan whereby Israel would seize the Sinai Peninsula and Britain and France would seize the Suez Canal and then topple Nasser. The Israeli military successfully carried out its part of the plan. Overall, however, the whole thing was a big fiasco, thanks to American intervention. Eisenhower used economic pressure to bring the British and the French invasion to a screeching halt. A few months later, he presented the Israeli premier, Ben Gurion, with enough pressure to force him also to retreat from Sinai, in return for virtually no concessions from Nasser. These events sound like ancient history today, but they were formative events not just for Sadat, but also for President Richard Nixon and for Prime Minister Golda Meir. In 1956, Nixon was Eisenhower's vice president. He idolized Eisenhower, but he concluded that undermining the British, French, and Israelis in the Suez Crisis was Eisenhower's biggest mistake in his foreign policy ever. Golda Meir, at the time, was the foreign minister in Ben-Gurion's government, presiding over the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Sinai without getting anything in return was traumatizing for her, as she makes clear in her memoirs. Eisenhower's support for Nasser in the Suez Crisis turned the Egyptian leader into a figure 10 feet tall in the Arab world. But the American role in his victory was not publicly known. Consequently, Nasser's reputation as the scourge of European imperialism and Zionism reached mythic status. Years later, the Lebanese poet Nizar Kabani wrote the following sycophantic lines: "You intoxicated us as the Sufi is intoxicated by the deity. For us, you are the Messiah, you are the liberator." But Sadat, in his memoirs, argues that in 1956, Nasser took a wrong turn. He became a prisoner of his own myth. Sadat writes, "Nasser was preoccupied with the fable which came to be associated with his name, both in Egypt and in the Arab world, that he was a hero who defeated the armies of the two great empires, the British and the French. Having completely disregarded the real part played by Eisenhower to that end, which turned military defeat into political victory, he became the first to believe that he had won. He could never see that he had in fact been militarily defeated," end quote. When did Sadat first conclude that Nasser had taken a wrong turn? The answer is not clear, but the War of Attrition was probably the event that set his convictions in stone. Nasser launched the war in March 1969 and accepted a ceasefire in August 1970. In restarting the conflict with Israel, Nasser sought to achieve three goals simultaneously. First, to restore the morale and the fighting ability of the Egyptian army after the 1967 catastrophe. And second, to prevent the Bar-Lev line, that was the Israeli defensive line, from becoming a permanent international frontier. And third, and most importantly, to exhaust Israel so as to regain the Sinai Peninsula for Egypt, as well as the territories that Israel had taken from Jordan and Syria in the 1967 war. In the first stage of the war, that is the war of attrition, the fighting remained localized along the canal, a kind of trench warfare in a way. Sporadic commando raids across enemy lines punctuated a war that was otherwise a static conflict with heavy artillery duels, dogfights, and aerial bombardments. Once the Israelis realized that Egypt was pursuing an exhaustion strategy, that it was prepared for a prolonged conflict, they began organizing raids deep into Egyptian territory. These included both airstrikes and commando operations targeting locations far west of the Suez Canal, sometimes within a few miles of Cairo. Facilities such as air bases, radar installations, military camps, and supply depots. In addition to disrupting Egyptian military capabilities, the objective of these deep penetration raids was to shake Nasser's regime politically. The raids indeed sent Nasser reeling, but instead of buckling, he turned to the Soviet Union for even more assistance. In early January 1970, Nasser made a secret trip to Moscow, where he made an emotional appeal for better weapons. Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet premier, responded by launching Operation Kavkaz, which delivered to Egypt a very large number of state-of-the-art surface-to-air missiles and MiG fighter jets. But in addition to the hardware, Moscow also provided men. Soviet pilots flew the MiGs, and Egyptian soldiers manned the surface-to-air missiles. At its peak, the number of Russian soldiers directly involved in the fighting probably reached 15,000 men on the ground and possibly as many as 150 pilots in the air. The war became a Russian-Israeli conflict. I think I'm correct in saying that this was the only time since the beginning of the Cold War that the Soviets sent their own men into combat outside of the communist bloc. The Israelis turned to the United States for assistance, asking both for public displays of support against Moscow and increased arms sales. Instead of escalating the conflict, however, President Nixon responded by tasking Secretary of State Rogers to seek a 90-day ceasefire. Both sides accepted. Now, this is an important point, because the Rogers plan was an exclusively American plan. The Soviets had no role in it, and in fact, they didn't like it, of course. So already under Nasser, we're seeing a perceptible movement by the Egyptians in the direction of Washington. And remember, Nasser was a canny fellow. He knew how to rain fire and brimstone down on the West, but also how to turn a few hot dogs and Esther Williams flicks into a geopolitical coup. Nasser died on September 28, 1970, shortly after he had accepted the ceasefire in the War of Attrition. So Sadat's evaluation of that war becomes exceptionally consequential. It forms the strategy that he would follow in the Yom Kippur War, or the Ramadan War, as he would call it. Sadat was the leader of a pan-Arab coalition dedicated ultimately to destroying Israel. But we can now see that he was also an Egyptian nationalist. By that I mean that his primary goal was to win back the Egyptian land that Israel had conquered in 1967, not to obliterate the Jewish state for the sake of Arab honor. And on this basis, he drew five major lessons. First, that Egypt had become dangerously dependent on the Soviet Union. The legacy of Nasser left me in a pitiable condition, Sadat wrote in his memoirs. In the sphere of foreign policy, I found that we had no relations with any country except the Soviet Union. Second, Moscow was decidedly ambivalent about Egypt's goals. On the one hand, the defeat of the Arabs in 1967 had been a defeat for the Soviet Union as well. Moscow, therefore, had an interest in helping Egypt reverse its fortunes. On the other hand, the Soviets were skeptical that a military victory was possible, and they were also fearful of being dragged into a war with the United States. What the Russians really wanted was a state of controlled tension between the Soviet camp and the American camp, one that they could exploit and exacerbate at will. Third, Egypt's Arab partners were of limited military use. Under Nasser, Egypt had become the leader of a pan-Arab coalition whose stated goal was to destroy Israel. Egypt's allies, especially Syria, objected strenuously to the slightest hint of compromise with the Jewish state. But those allies could not begin to match Egypt's contribution to the war effort. Fourth, the Americans were indispensable. Only Washington could convince the Israelis to evacuate the Sinai. Sadat writes in his memoirs that in the final months of the War of Attrition, even Nasser himself was thinking about gravitating toward Washington. "Listen, Anwar," Nasser told Sadat, "whether we like it or not, all the cards in this game are in America's hands. It's high time we talked and allowed the USA to take part in this." Fifth and most bitterly, it was impossible to ignore Israel politically. Golda Meir's relations with Nixon and Kissinger were so intimate that a strategy which sought to bypass Jerusalem altogether would inevitably fail. There's no reason to disbelieve Sadat when he says that Nasser was gravitating toward the Americans. But significant evidence also indicates that Nasser saw the ceasefire in 1970 purely as a tactic for regrouping. He intended to exploit the lull in the fighting to gain advantage and then to restart the war in another few months. Indeed, as we already saw, the Egyptian military and the Soviets violated the ceasefire by moving surface-to-air missiles up to the canal line, the foundations of the SAM wall that would prove lethal to the Israeli Air Force in 1973 were laid in 1970. Let's assume that Nasser was indeed interested in engaging the Americans, but was also planning a new round of fighting. In that case, his strategic calculus went as follows. A new Soviet-Egyptian offensive would alarm the Americans. They would increase their efforts to mediate. Their mediation would translate into American pressure on Israel. That pressure would mimic the pressure that Eisenhower had placed on Ben-Gurion in 1957, when Eisenhower had compelled the Israelis to withdraw from Sinai. The Americans would negotiate the terms of the Israeli withdrawal exactly as the withdrawal from Sinai had been handled in 1957. This arrangement would allow Nasser to have his cake and eat it too. He could liberate Egyptian territory without risking all-out war with Israel or without appearing to compromise. In other words, he could remain a pan-Arab hero. Nasser's calculus formed the baseline for Sadat's strategy in the 1973 war. But Sadat changed the calculus in two notable ways. First, he compressed the military timeline. Instead of a protracted war designed to exhaust the Israelis, he planned to deliver a very sharp and stunning initial blow, a blow that would leave Israel reeling. Second, he realized that times had changed. The attitudes of Nixon and Kissinger were very different from the attitudes of the Americans in the early Eisenhower era. They could not be relied upon to play the role that Nasser's strategy assigned to them. To deploy American power against Israel successfully, Egypt would first have to convince Washington of three things. One, that it operated independently of the Soviet Union. Two, that it could live comfortably in an American-led order. And three, that its claims against Israel were limited and exclusively territorial. That is, it wanted an Israeli withdrawal from the territories occupied in 1967, not Israel's destruction. In short, Sadat had to convince Nixon and Kissinger that Egypt, Syria, and Jordan were appeasable powers. To put it in terms that I used in an earlier lecture, he had to convince them that he was the sort of leader whom Israeli accommodationists and their American counterparts could believe in. And thus was born the strategy that took Sadat into the Yom Kippur War. A hybrid, this strategy combined elements of the military campaign that Nasser had been developing in 1970, but it added to it the American-friendly orientation that the Egyptians had followed in the early 1950s. That American-friendly orientation had delivered to Nasser the greatest victories of his career, and it had also delivered to the West some of its worst defeats in the Middle East. Literally moments before Nasser was laid to rest, Sadat set about convincing the Nixon administration that Egypt was appeasable and hungry for America's love. Elliot Richardson, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, led the official American delegation to Nasser's funeral. As the funeral procession was winding its way to Nasser's burial site, it stopped, with no explanation, in the middle of Zamalek, an upscale district of Cairo. The Egyptian officials ushered Soviet Premier Kosygin, Chinese Premier Chou Enlai, and Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, and dozens of other dignitaries into a tent where they waited for an extended period until the procession resumed. While the other distinguished guests were left to wonder what was happening, Egyptian officials quietly came and whisked Richardson away. They took him out of the tent and into the basement of a nearby building, where he found Sadat laid out on a cot, suffering from heat stroke. The procession, Richardson now realized, had stopped so that Sadat could recover. While resting, Sadat seized the opportunity to court the Americans. He thanked the United States personally for sending a high-level delegation, and he asked Richardson to come see him before leaving town. At their meeting the following day, Sadat asked Richardson to inform President Nixon that Egypt wanted to build an entirely new, friendly, and cooperative relationship with the United States. Shortly thereafter, Sadat sent his first letter to Nixon. He emphasized that Egypt was not a puppet of the Soviet government, even while this country continued to rely heavily on Soviet assistance. "You would be mistaken to think that we are in the Soviet sphere of influence," he wrote. "We are not within the Soviet sphere of influence, nor for that matter, anybody else's sphere of influence." He also made it clear that he was prepared to begin a dialogue. "If you wish to talk about anything concerning Egypt, the venue will be in Cairo, and the talks will be with me, not with any other party." The implication here is obvious. Sadat wanted the United States to establish a direct personal line to him and not to negotiate with him through Moscow. Sadat distrusted his own foreign ministry. He had that in common with Nixon and Kissinger and also with Golda Meir. He therefore appointed an intermediary to act as a direct channel between him and the American embassy. Who did he choose? Mohammad Hassanein Haeckel, the same guy that Nasser had trusted as a go-between with William Lakeland some 20 years earlier. Sadat's courtship of the Americans quickly bore fruit. In early May 1971, Nixon sent his Secretary of State, William Rogers, to Cairo. Sadat lost no time in making the same pitch to Rogers that Nasser had made to John Foster Dulles some 20 years earlier. The minute the two men sat down together, Sadat spoke as follows. "I know what's uppermost on your mind, and I want to talk about it at once. That's the Soviet Union. I would like to become much closer with the West. There's no reason why the Arabs should be closer aligned to the Soviet Union. My people like the West better. We appreciate your values, and we appreciate our association with the West. Business opportunities," he said. "I like American businessmen." Say what you will, but Sadat knew his audience. He reinforced this pro-American rhetoric with concrete actions. He launched his corrective revolution, in which he purged leaders of the pro-Soviet faction in his government, and he made sure that the American embassy got the message. In a dispatch back to Washington, the embassy reported that this move marked a victory for the good guys. Sadat also launched at this time what he would later call his peace initiative, an innovative proposal for reducing tensions between Egypt and Israel. In February 1971, he proposed that Israel should pull back some 20 miles from the east bank of the Suez Canal, and Egypt would thin out its forces on the western bank. The canal would then reopen to international commercial transit. Full peace would await, however. Around the same time, Sadat told Gunnar Jahring, the UN mediator for the Arab-Israeli conflict, that he would be willing to end belligerency with Israel, but, and this is an important point, only after Israel withdrew from all the territories occupied in 1967. Yitzhak Rabin, Israel's ambassador to Washington at this time, writes in his memoir, "Whatever else anyone might say about this idea, it was certainly a refreshing change from the high-stakes, all-or-nothing atmosphere that surrounded all of the final settlement proposals related to Resolution 242, that is, to the UN resolution that ended the Six-Day War. For that reason alone," Rabin continued, "it merited serious thought." This episode, therefore, has generated the most intriguing what-if question of the Arab-Israeli conflict. What if the United States and Israel had taken Sadat up on this offer? Could the Camp David Accords have come 7 years earlier? Was the bloodshed and the trauma of the Yom Kippur War the result of a failure of imagination in 1971? Personally, I'm very dubious about this, but I'll explain why in a later episode. For the moment, let's just focus on a specific aspect of the proposal, namely its origins. The original author of the proposal was none other than Moshe Dayan, the defense minister of Israel, who had floated the idea informally in diplomatic circles without Israeli cabinet approval. Not surprisingly, Sadat's initiative sparked a very significant and multifaceted debate among the Israelis about how to respond. The debate went on for weeks, and it created friction among senior Israeli officials and between them as a group and the Nixon administration. Sadat's peace initiative caused some of the worst tensions between Kissinger and Rabin personally, relations that were normally very friendly and smooth. In hundreds of meetings and conversations and contacts, I had rarely seen Kissinger so furious, Rabin writes in his memoirs about one particularly heated fight with Kissinger over this question. The important point here is that Sadat was engaging the Israelis in addition to engaging the Americans. He had departed from Nasser's approach of simply borrowing American power to roll back Israel, and he was actively seeking to change the psychology in Jerusalem. One actor who recognized the change was the American Assistant Secretary of State, Joe Sisko. He visited Cairo in this period. Rabin writes in his memoirs that Sisko came back from the trip, quote, profoundly impressed by Sadat's desire for peace, unquote. Sisko, quote, found Sadat full of understanding for Israel's problems. He had never heard an Arab leader express himself in such a manner, placing himself in Israel's shoes. Sadat gave rational consideration to Israel's need for security, unquote. To be sure, Sadat's abilities to see the world through the eyes of the Israelis set him apart from other Arab leaders of the day. But his capacity for empathy was not quite as unique as Sisko thought. In 1953 and 1954, Nasser advertised to American diplomats that he harbored no special animus toward Israel. In his famous book, The Philosophy of the Revolution, which, by the way, was ghostwritten by Hassanein Haeckel, that drew the attention of his readers to an American magazine called The Jewish Observers. That magazine contained the recollections of one Yerucham Cohen, an Israeli soldier. During the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, Cohen and Nasser became acquainted with one another after Israeli forces had encircled Egyptian troops in the southern Negev near Beersheba. At the time, Nasser held the rank of major, and he served as an assistant to the Egyptian commander of the sector, Taha Bey. Cohen, for his part, was an aide to the Israeli commander, Yigal Alon. As the two commanders negotiated, Nasser and Cohen, a Yemenite Jew who was fluent in Arabic, talked about more than just military matters. Nasser, in The Philosophy of the Revolution, he quoted what Cohen had to say about him, about Nasser. "The subject that Gamal Abdel Nasser discussed with me," said Cohen, "was Israel's struggle against the English, how we succeeded in mobilizing world opinion against them." Now, note what's going on here. Nasser is doing several things simultaneously. He's writing this in Arabic for his Egyptian audience. He's signaling to his Egyptian audience that he's more concerned with the fight against Britain than he is with the fight against Israel. At the same time, this book, which was translated into English and disseminated in the United States by the CIA, no less, it shows to an American audience that Nasser is not particularly hostile to Jews, is even willing to write in Arabic about how he's reading the Jewish Observer, something that of course never happened, somebody put that in front of him. But anyway, he's showing no particular animus either toward Cohen or toward Israel. He was showcasing Cohen's observations in order to court the Americans. That's the point here. By showing willingness to negotiate with Israel, he affirmed his moderate pro-Western credentials, and he gave Washington the sense that he might in the future actually help them solve the Arab-Israeli conflict. And believe me, it worked. Sadat in 1971 was playing a similar card with similar goals. What's interesting here, however, is that he realized that softening up the Americans also required softening up the Israelis. But Sadat's 1971 overtures failed to go anywhere. The Americans were distracted by the Vietnam War and the presidential elections of 1972. As for the Israelis, the price that Sadat demanded from them was just too steep. So Sadat launched a second initiative to get the attention of Nixon and Kissinger, and that was in July 1972. He expelled the Soviet military personnel from Egypt. Through Hafez Ismail, the National Security Advisor, he opened a direct channel to Kissinger. In February 1973, Ismail met with Kissinger and informed him that Egypt would be willing to sign a peace agreement with Israel that could involve demilitarized zones on both sides of the international border and peacekeepers in sensitive areas like Sharm el-Sheikh, which were crucial to Israeli freedom of navigation. The Israelis, when presented with the offer, responded with uncertainty. Nixon and Kissinger favored postponing a major diplomatic initiative until after the Israeli elections, which were scheduled for late October. Despite Sadat's publicly expressed frustrations with the lack of progress and expressions of concern about the explosive potential of the situation, Nixon and Kissinger were convinced that the balance of power strongly favored Israel against Egypt and Syria. The American intelligence community, of course, completely agreed. Kissinger communicated to Sadat his desire to launch a peace initiative after the Israeli election, which, as I said, was scheduled for late October. War is the continuation of politics by other means. Through his 1971 disengagement plan and his secret channel between Hafez Ismail and the White House, Sadat wrote the script for Kissinger's diplomacy after the war. The moment the war broke out, therefore, Kissinger knew exactly what his role as peacemaker would entail. That is probably, I would say, one of the reasons why Kissinger advised the Israelis not to launch a preemptive strike against Egypt when the attack finally came. He feared another 1967 victory that would cut off any possibility of a diplomatic settlement. Although Sadat laid out a very clear roadmap for the post-war diplomacy, he also kept everybody guessing. The expulsion of the Soviet military personnel in July 1972 was a case in point. As I noted earlier, Kissinger's first reaction to the move was to say to Nixon, "I think the guy is highly unstable." Following that observation, Kissinger provided Nixon with three possible motives for Sadat's gambit. First, he said, it might be an attempt to blackmail the Russians. Sadat was threatening to break with Moscow unless they provided him with the long-range offensive weapons that he needed in order to attack Israel. The day before expelling the Soviets, Sadat had complained publicly that the Kremlin was too cautious militarily. The second possibility, Kissinger told Nixon, is that Sadat wanted to make a move toward the United States. The third possibility, which Kissinger called the most worrisome one, was that Sadat was getting rid of the Russians so that, in Kissinger's words, he can jump the Israelis and force the Russians into supporting him. Of course, we now know that Sadat was actually pursuing all of these three goals simultaneously. Kissinger's memoirs are also very insightful on this point, and they merit quoting at length. Sadat, Kissinger writes, paralyzed his opponents with their own preconceptions. I want to read that sentence again because I like it. Sadat paralyzed his opponents with their own preconceptions. He had been threatening to go to war every year since 1971. One year after another, he had loudly proclaimed as the year of decision. No threat had ever come close to being implemented. New threats of war were therefore dismissed as bluff. Israeli planners simply assumed that Egypt would not attack as long as it lacked air superiority, and no attack would come without at least 24 or 48 hours of warning. The United States would have time to intervene diplomatically, and Israel would have time to mobilize. The Arab nations were not expected to go to war without giving diplomacy one more chance. They would therefore wait for the results of our peace initiative, which we promised after the Israeli election on October 30th. All these assumptions turned out to be false. I'm still quoting Kissinger here. Sadat's unfulfilled threats camouflaged his intentions. Israel had barely 10 hours of warning, and Sadat saw no point in awaiting our diplomacy. Its probable outcome, some sort of interim agreement moving forces back from the Suez Canal, would serve none of his political purposes unless he could present it as having been exacted by Arab strength. The imminence of negotiations thus probably spurred rather than delayed his decision. He could afford to let us neither succeed, which would have mortgaged his domestic position, nor fail, which might have undermined our interest in mediation. The approaching diplomacy distorted the Israelis' perspective as well. They acquired a vested interest in belittling Arab threats, lest the United States use the danger of war as a pretext to press Israel for concessions. End of quote. Good strategists work to solve contradictions. Great strategists exploit them to their benefit. Sadat was a master manipulator of contradictions. He fought a war as a Soviet proxy to move Egypt into the American camp. He constructed a pan-Arab coalition designed so that Egypt could break away from pan-Arabism. And he hit Israel with the greatest blow that it had ever received in order to compromise with it. But compromise with Israel was a means to a greater end. Sadat was changing Egypt's posture toward capitalism and the West, offering the country some repose after decades of turmoil. He was shedding Egypt's Nasserist skin and returning the country to a more particularistic Egyptian nationalism. For nearly two decades, Egypt had led the Arabs in a revolt against the West and Zionism. The fact that the same country was suddenly ready to begin negotiations with Israel and, in the process, to move from the Soviet to the American camp in the Cold War boggled the mind. An extraordinarily shrewd judge of character, Sadat could read the motivations of people whom he had never met and who were far removed from him by both distance and culture. He was brilliant, he was wily, and he was bold. We do not diminish his greatness if we also observe that he was a product of modern Egyptian history. His capacity to finely calibrate a mix of political initiative and extreme violence owed as much to his experiences in the struggle against Britain in the 1950s as to his natural talents. As I hope I've made clear by now, the target of Sadat's military and diplomatic maneuvers was America as much as it was Israel. In the next episode, we'll examine how those overtures looked to the people in Washington and how they responded. Let me at this point repeat something that I have said often before, usually to the extreme annoyance of my American friends. However history judges Richard Nixon, and it is probable that the verdict will be very harsh, it must also be put on the record forever that he did not break a single one of the promises he made to us.